This week we get the straight story on the Battle of Gettysburg and the Friend to a Friend Monument. Erected in 1993, this monument proliferated a number of romantic tales about brothers helping brothers, even in wartime. How true is it? This week, Worshipful Brother Patrick Day tackles the question using perhaps the best information available, Most Worshipful Brother Michael Halloran's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Freemasonry in the Civil War. Then we'll take a look at some contemporary science stories that are affecting us all, including an inspirational tale about a planet and a moon and their watery connection. And we'll wrap it up with a bit about the solar eclipse happening next month and why it's so important. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 630. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. This show happens because of you. It's no small endeavor requiring hours of work each week on top of what we all have, work, kids, spouses, all of that. And, of course, if you head on over to our website, WCYpodcast.com, you'll see a number of ways to assist us in listener-supported Masonic education, your trusted source for Masonic education. No Illuminati stuff, no 2-3 year in quote-unquote Masonic experts, no subjective narrowing of state information only. We're talking about global Freemasonry and all that that encompasses, with widely accepted objective information, great papers, and research along the way. So if something like that interests you and you've always thought, hey, I love this show, how can I give back? That's how. Head on over to the website, click on Support the Show, or you can click on the shop. A little update to the shop is that, of course, we are currently sold out of our producer's pin. If you've ordered a producer's pin and have not received it, please reach out to me so that we can get it squared away. I have a couple orders that are sitting in the queue, and those cannot be fulfilled until I get the new pin. But if you are one of those people who wanted this pin and nothing else will suffice, please contact me. I have no problem issuing you a refund for the pin. I do want to thank you in advance for your patience. As far as presentations go, the next one I've got coming up is going to be on April 2nd. It's Esoterics 101, designed to be a beginning look into the deeper mysteries of Freemasonry. It's really ideal for a lodge that needs to be exposed to the concept of esoteric masonry, quote-unquote, or, as we might say today, philosophic masonry, schools of wisdom, hidden symbolism, and the presentation hints at an ultimate revelation, all to be explored. Now, of course, this also happens to be a presentation that talks about many other schools of wisdom, quote-unquote, of which Freemasonry is one. But why Freemasonry is so important. This will be happening at Middleton Ionic Lodge, number 180 in Middleton, Wisconsin. After that, April 6th, I will be flying into London, Ontario, Canada, for London's Day of Masonry. I'll be doing a guest lecture there. After that, the following weekend, I'll be doing a joint council and chapter meeting here in the Chicagoland area. And then the Tetragrammaton, the Lost Word, on April 13th. I'll be doing that at Richmond Randolph Lodge, number 19 in Richmond, Virginia. I'll be virtually presenting for Ontario Mason on April 29th. What I'm very excited about is the upcoming March 23rd Illinois Lodge of Research Tri-Annual Symposium on Masonic History. This is going to be taking place again March 23rd, just this upcoming Saturday. If you're listening to this on the day of release, it's Monday. So you've got a few days to let us know that you'll be coming. However, a little bit about the event. It's going to be very awesome. So this event promises to be an enlightening experience as we delve into the rich heritage and significance of Masonic history. Now, the symposium itself is going to feature distinguished speakers, including Darren A. Laners, who is a fellow of the Illinois Lodge of Research. I will also be doing a presentation, but the special thing is we've got a keynote address by the Senior Grand Warden of the Grand Lodge of Illinois, Right Worshipful Brother Austin Gene Smith. Now, he's our keynote speaker, and he's going to deliver an engaging presentation on the history of the Grand Lodge of Illinois, offering unique insights into our Masonic legacy. What is wild about the Grand Lodge of Illinois is we've actually had two Grand Lodges. One went defunct and then we came back. and where did we start? And there's all of this kind of conjecture about this sort of thing, and probably nobody knows more about this currently than Right Worshipful Brother Gene Smith. Aside from being a Grand Lodge officer, he had been interested in the history of the Grand Lodge of Illinois well before ever becoming a Grand Lodge officer. This has been an endeavor for him for several years. So the day will commence with a warm welcome accompanied by coffee and donuts for those who have registered. Presentations will officially begin at about 9 a.m., where you'll have the opportunity to expand your knowledge and engage in meaningful discussions with fellow Masons. Now, the event is going to foster fellowship and provide excellent networking platform, also a place to bring your friends who might be interested in Freemasonry. Do they want to join? They can still come. There's nothing secret. We want to emphasize that this symposium, again, is open to all Masons, regardless of the degree. So entered apprentices, fellow crafts, and master Masons are all welcome to attend. Welcome to attend and enrich their understanding of Masonic history. In fact, you don't even need to be a member of the Lodge of Research to participate. Non-Mason prospective members are also welcomed. The symposium will be held at the prestigious Normal Masonic Lodge in Normal, Illinois. The location offers remarkable Masonic library, adding even more value to the engaging educational experience. We sincerely encourage you to mark your calendars and to come out and join us for this extraordinary event. Please be prepared to embark on a journey through history that resonates with every Mason. The symposium is completely free. Yeah, free. Ensuring an accessibility for everyone. All you have to do is RSVP at your earliest convenience, hopefully before Friday. I'm hoping I get most of them by Thursday, but we need to get a good head count if you want coffee and a donut. So simply send me an email at admin@wcypodcast.com, put in the subject line, hey, I want to register for the ILOR Symposium, or you can hit me up at webmaster@IllinoisLodgeOfResearch.org. We anticipate a high level of interest and encourage early registration to guarantee attendance. So don't miss out on this exceptional opportunity to enrich your Masonic knowledge, especially if you're interested in any of the history of Freemasonry. Now, a couple of items, too. What time is it going to end? I said between 1 and 2 p.m. is likely. Will this be on Zoom? No. It is an in-person only event. However, we will record the presentations and we'll make them available to our members via the website on a members section. The dress code, business casual, is just fine. What are the presentations going to be on? Well, I already let you know about Right Worshipful Brother Austin Gene Smith's presentation. He'll be our keynote and finishing out the day. Opening up for him, of course, will be Darren A. Laners and myself. I'll be presenting on the Masonic Pub Crawl, Freemasonry in America and its Colonial Tavern Beginnings. It'll be an examination of Masonry as it existed in those days that led up to the America's Decree of Independence. Exclusive rare documents are probably going to blow your mind if you haven't seen them already. And then in a premiere presentation prepared just for this event, Brother Darren Laners has his presentation titled Isaac Newton, Polymath, Alchemist, and Freemason. Step into the mysterious world of Isaac Newton as he delves into the groundbreaking scientific discoveries, his hidden alchemical pursuits, and his enigmatic ties to our secret brotherhood of Freemasonry. Uncover the untold stories and unravel the legacy of one of history's greatest minds in a captivating presentation that unveils the multifaceted genius of Isaac Newton. So we'll have some history going along there, and I hope to see you all out at the Illinois Lodge of Research Triannual Symposium on Masonic History. If you want to get on the email list, head on over to IllinoisLodgeOfResearch.org and just fill out the form to get on the list. And if you want to come to the event, well, just shoot me an email at admin@wcypodcast.com or at webmaster@IllinoisLodgeOfResearch.org, and I'll take care of you. All right, with all that out of the way, I want to go ahead and get into this week's Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. This is something that's been talked about for quite some time, and we've been sort of fighting to get the truth out about this for a number of years now. And so with that, let's get into it.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out of context quotes on memes and sound bites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
If you ever find yourself at the site of the most notorious battle of the American Civil War, probably because you had to watch the Ken Burns documentary in grade school, that of Gettysburg, you will find on the south end of the town two very notable monuments. The Soldiers' National Monument is the more prominent monument on the site, which had its cornerstone laid by the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania on July 4th, 1865. And nearby this is another monument called the Friend to Friend Monument, erected by the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania in 1993. This monument depicts a federal soldier bowed over and lifting up a wounded Confederate soldier. These two soldiers depicted are Brigadier General Lewis Addison Armistead of the Confederate Army and Captain Henry Harrison Bingham, federal officer under the command of Major General Winfield Scott Hancock. All three of these men were Freemasons. It is said that during the infamous Pickett's Charge, Armistead was wounded and gave the Masonic sign of distress, and was tended to by Bingham, who, under the order of Armistead's old friend, Hancock, saw to it that Armistead was medically tended to, made it safely to a hospital, and that his possessions were kept safe, including Armistead's Bible. It is a heartwarming story, if true. So, to assess the legitimacy of this tale, we need to back up and look at how we even got to this point in the first place. Now, before proceeding, for some, the descriptions I will give can be graphic and may be triggering to some if you're uncomfortable with descriptions of violence, death, and destruction in war. Then this may not be for you, and you may just want to skip all this. I give that warning because the Civil War was single-handedly the most bloody and horrific war in American military history, with a death toll that exceeds all other American military conflicts combined. Now, depending on the sources used and whoever's updating the Wikipedia pages, that scale may have finally tipped recently, but without a doubt, no other American war rivals the Civil War in the number of dead. I truly don't think there has ever been an accurate film that depicts the Civil War that truly captures the revilingly high death toll and the overall horror and gore that was so prominent in this war. As Hegel once remarked, and I'm saying this totally out of context here, history is a slaughter bench. Now, I really don't like to concern myself too deeply with military tactics in the Civil War. Things like, which company flanked which, and who commanded which divisions, and how many were in a single charge, etc. I usually just stick to what led up to the battle. When and where was the battle? Who won? How did that affect later events in the war? And that's about it. I used to care more about those things back when I would study up on battles. And then I'd go to the reenactments as a spectator, but, from the sidelines, I'd taunt the losing army. Or I'd yell at the losing army how they could, change the tides of war. But I'm not 20 anymore. These days, I'm more concerned with the politics of the war. I much prefer to read the congressional proceedings and, the Congressional Globe, as well as letters between political and military leaders, more than I really pay attention to the actual battle tactics. Yeah, they just don't concern me too much anymore. However, in discussing the events at Gettysburg, particularly those during Pickett's Charge, the events that led up to the inspiration for this Masonic monument at Gettysburg, we will need to get a bit technical in the tactics, as, accounts differ, and that affects the authenticity of whether a brother really did give a sign of distress, and if a brother answered the call. Now, most Masonic tellings of this event are really brief, and they usually spend more time just discussing the war, in particular, most of the significant details of the Battle of Gettysburg, a lot of which I find to be primarily based on Ron Maxwell's film Gettysburg. And then they barely cover the exact details of how a brother came to give the sign of distress, and a brother from the enemy army answered his call. The first I can find of anyone really questioning this tale is Michael A. Holleran in his work, The Better Angels of Our Nature, published in 2010. Holleran's text is a must-read. Over the years, I've come across countless tales of brothers helping brothers in the Civil War, much of which is fluffed up or completely unverifiable. But Holleran's book is a critical analysis of Freemasonry during the Civil War. It is realistic and honest, with numerous verified examples of brothers helping brothers, and other times, not. I mean, war is war. Brothers do not always act like brothers. Given the outright carnage and hostility, it is heartwarming to encounter moments of decency, and even more so when a brother Mason helps another brother Mason, be they enemies or friends bound by the mystic cords of memory. I hear it a lot today, people saying, you know, that this country's never been more divided in its history. When they say that, I tend to gesture towards the Civil War. Yet, Holleran's book is fantastic because he really analyzes Masons interacting with Masons in an honest way. Sometimes it's just how war is conducted, and Masons tend to favor Masons, so sometimes it wasn't that special. Just a slight advantage by mutual membership, but I guess that's something. He even illustrates moments where being an odd fellow was an advantage. And certainly there were moments where Masons screwed over enemy Masons. It happens. War is hell. And in the case of Armistead's part in Pickett's charge, and if a brother Mason helped him, well, that is overhyped, if not outright false. Thus, I'll be relying primarily on Holleran's work here, because it is the most detailed analysis of this event. Like, he goes into details that I only ever see in Civil War textbooks. Things like companies and divisions and diary entries by men who were at the scene of the high water mark that day, etc. Now, the short account of how we even got to Pickett's charge is that if you look at a map of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, it is like a wagon wheel, in which about a dozen major thoroughfares go in and out of the town radially. And it just so happened to be an unfortunate nexus for numerous armies to converge. No, it was not fought over frickin' shoes. I don't care what those documentaries said. Now, firing started on July 1st, 1863, and drawing a stalemate. Then each side called in for reinforcements, so there was no fighting on the second day. The third day was the crucial point of fighting. The Union Army held a line on Cemetery Ridge with Confederates out to the west of this line. The Confederates had a daring idea to just rush and break the Union Corps, dividing the armies and thus making it easier to pick off two disorganized lines rather than one strongly held line. It was a daring bravado tactic, which was common among Confederate troops. Such helps spice up, you know, history books with these heroic charges, especially compared to how the Union was just so pragmatic. But these bravado tactics frequently cost the Confederate armies more dearly than they help. And in the case of Pickett's charge, it cost them much. So they started with one of the most fantastic and horrific bombardments on American soil. Seriously, this was the largest bombardment on American soil ever. Like, this was crazy. 150 artillery units blasted unrelentingly for like 2 hours. Now, accounts at the center of Cemetery Ridge report that they experienced approximately 6 cannon or canister shots a minute. The federal troops mostly held steadfast through the bombardment, though there was certainly some initial return fire. This was because the Confederates' artillery was subpar, to put it politely. They had exhausted all their good munitions early in the war, much of which had been raided from federal strongholds prior to the war having officially started. Seeing as the North was a manufacturing powerhouse, raiding their munition stocks was kind of a smart move, especially since they were able to do so without any bloodshed. But once it was all exhausted, the South, well, they had to make do with homemade. As a result, much of the Confederates' aim was off. The fuses went off either too early or too late, which meant they hit either nothing, or they overshot and hit horses and men in the rear. But it did little to disrupt the front line. I mean, sure, they hit plenty of Federal soldiers and were struck and killed, but it wasn't enough that they couldn't easily recover. Most of the damage to the Union lines was in the rear, which produced a bit of chaos, but again, not enough to affect the front line. One account tells of a Union commanding officer, I think it was Alexander Webb. He got out his pipe and started smoking it while leaning against a tree under the bombardment after he realized the artillery was just a lot of sound and fury. Now, this is where the Confederates were at a disadvantage. Due to the literal fog of war, so much smoke and dust, they could not see if their bombardment was successful, and they nonetheless proceeded to charge, which was a bad move. Now, the frontal attack was led by four main divisions. Major General George Pickett's men leading the right flank to charge the center, then followed by Armistead's men. Then on the left flank was Brigadier General James Johnson Pettigrew, his men charging straight ahead, then followed by Major General Isaac R. Trimble. It wasn't really a charge in the way we classically think of a charge. You know, we call it the charge and it seems really dramatic. It was more like a steady march to keep rank, so that when the time came, they were all, you know, file-dressed and ready to unleash a steady volley of fire. However, because their impressive yet futile bombardment did little to break the Union front line, they were basically marching into whatever they would have marched into had they not unleashed a maelstrom of fire in the first place. They quickly lost rank, and so very quickly they deteriorated into small groups of, you know, soldiers fighting in small brigades rather than a well-assembled line of fire. And here's where the story of the Masonic Monument at Gettysburg comes in. As a matter of fate having a cruel sense of humor, Armistead's men were headed for Hancock's division. Armistead and Hancock had actually been close buddies before the war, and they were facing off with each other. Ironic, I know. This was actually a potential key turning point in the rapidly failing charge. This was called the high water mark, the point where the Confederates made it the farthest across the Union lines than anywhere else. As Armistead's men attempted to cross a point in the stone wall, it's a big long stone wall in this portion of Cemetery Ridge, the wall then suddenly curved significantly, which got the nickname the angle. Armistead got lucky, as this was a point where the Union troops had fallen back. There was an artillery regiment under the command of 1st Lieutenant Alonzo Cushing, 4th U.S. Artillery. Cushing was hit by several shell fragments, one of which actually cut open his abdomen, and he had to hold in his intestines with his own hand, and he would ultimately be shot through the head. His 2nd Lieutenant, Joseph Milne, was also killed. Thus, 1st Sergeant Frederick W. Fugger took command. The men abandoned the artillery and fell back a short distance for a brief time, so Armistead took the opportunity. Numerous reports state that Armistead himself crossed over the angle, and as he did so, he held aloft his hat upon the point of his sword as he called to his men, "Give 'em the cold steel, boys." I gotta admit, that's a pretty badass line. Too bad he never actually was able to fire his gun. Reports vary, but only about 7 of his men, maybe 8, crossed the angle with him. Most reports, both Union and Confederate, concur that Armistead gave the command to turn the guns on the Federal troops, but before he could even put his hand upon Cushing's abandoned artillery there, he was gunned down, shot in the arm and the chest, and he fell to the ground, but he had not died yet. The high water mark was thus very short-lived, with the men following Armistead being immediately gunned down or retreating back over the angle. Fugger's men, being only a short distance away, advanced upon the Confederates and engaging in close hand-to-hand combat, either killing them or taking them prisoner. Here accounts differ. Armistead is said by some to have given the Masonic sign of distress. However, these instances become debatable. One of the closest men to Armistead when he was gunned down was Private Milton Harding of the 9th Virginia, Company G, who came up beside him and asked if he could do anything for him. Armistead requested to have his flask of brandy brought to him, which Harding fetched from his satchel, and Armistead had a sip or two before ordering Harding to just look after himself. Harding retreated and was captured. Then there was Sergeant Drury B. Easley of the 14th Virginia Company H, who was probably the second closest. He actually believed that Armistead was dead when shot down. Easley would actually later become a Mason, and in 1913, 40 years later, mind you, he reports that he saw the advancing Yankees giving the sign of distress. Quote, "I ran squarely into the Yankees before seeing them and brought down my bayonet before seeing they had up the sign of distress." End quote. Letter to Howard Townsend, July 24, 1913. At the time, Easley may not have known what this sign was, but later upon becoming a Mason, he perhaps suddenly recognized it, hence his change in story decades later. But it was not Armistead that gave the sign of distress. It was the Yankees. Here's a bit of a spurious one. Modern historian Albert Nofi gives one of the most romantic accounts of Armistead making an appeal for Masonic help in his book, The Gettysburg Campaign. Quote, "As Confederate Brigadier General Lewis A. Armistead lay mortally wounded in the middle of the angle atop Cemetery Ridge, he uttered a cry for help, adding the phrase, 'As the son of a widow.' As the rebel tide was ebbing by then, some men on the line received permission to go to his aid. A romantic tradition has held it that one of them was First Sergeant Frederick Fugger of Cushing's Battery. Fugger had known Armistead in the pre-war army when both had served in the 6th Infantry and in Utah. According to one of Fugger's fellow gunners, Christopher Smith, Armistead said to Fugger, 'I thought it was you, Sergeant. If I had known that you were in command of that battery, I would have never led the charge against you.'" However, Fugger denied having known Armistead before the war in his sworn testimony before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. Fugger never mentions any Masonic indications of distress or any sign of distress whatsoever, because Nofi's not exactly the most reliable historian on this matter and other details. If any Masonic signifier of distress was given by Armistead, it must have been after the battle was over and the Union claimed victory. Charles Baines, from his own account of the 72nd Pennsylvania Regiment, published in 1876, he states that Armistead said, quote, "He called for help as the son of a widow," end quote. Armistead's revolver would be removed, according to Baines, and it was never returned to him, according to several Union men, and it was noted by several as well that he never fired a single shot from it. One Union soldier even sneered that, quote, "He obeyed his own command to give him the cold steel," end quote. Baines' account is interesting because he would later recount this event under sworn testimony and state that an anonymous man of the 72nd Pennsylvania reported hearing, hearsay mind you, quote, "a man calling for his mother who was a widow," end quote. There is no evidence that Baines was a Mason, so he may have been unaware of the Masonic significance of the phrase "widow's son." Perhaps the origin of the Armistead legend of having given the sign of distress comes from Captain John C. Brown of the 20th Indiana Company K, who recounts about a quarter of a century after the battle that, quote, "General Armistead was lifted up and borne from the field by virtue of the grand hailing sign of a Mason," end quote. This is in a letter to John B. Batchelor, July 1, 1887. Brown claims that he was the one who found the dying Armistead, and when he spoke to him, Armistead asked if he was a Mason. Brown replied that he was. Brown further claims he ordered two of his men to put Armistead on a stretcher and carry him to a Union hospital. However, no other accounts corroborate Brown's own recollection, and even he appears to doubt his own memory. His details simply do not match and sometimes completely contradict other reports. It's possible that Brown actually encountered another dying Confederate officer, but who is uncertain. This would actually happen to Bingham. Bingham actually had been confused about who the dying Confederate officer was that he came upon. What is certain by several accounts is that Armistead certainly had a conversation with a federal officer, but everyone else agrees that it was Bingham. Bingham is a reliable source, not necessarily by reputation, but by mere fact of his recounting of this meeting with the dying Armistead. It was only 5 years after the war. Many of these other guys have been writing about this stuff 40 years later. In this account, given in a letter January 1896, written to Hancock, he recounts how he told Armistead, while he was on ambulance, that he was under Hancock's command. Armistead, according to Bingham, admits regret to any harm given against Hancock, and Bingham would take Armistead's spurs, pocketbook, seal, and watch chain. No Bible. Bingham states that he is taking these valuable possessions to take care of, but not necessarily as a Masonic courtesy. In fact, it does not appear that Bingham understood Armistead was also a Mason, as he makes no mention of any Masonic communication whatsoever. Rather, this appears to just be a general custom of gentlemen observed during the war. We see this happen a lot, in fact. War was, at the time, still viewed kind of as a gentleman's affair and should be conducted as such. Some have asserted that it was a physician who received a Masonic plea for aid, but these are just as spurious. Daniel Garrison Brenton was the army physician who tended to Armistead. It is not known if he was a Mason, but I don't think he was, but he makes no mention of any Masonic communication with Armistead. He assessed that Armistead's wounds did not appear fatal, and he actually expressed surprise to learn that he died on July 5th, 1863. Hollering concludes his analysis of Gettysburg with his opinion that something Masonic probably occurred between Armistead and some federal officer or soldier, but that the usual story is a fiction. I am, however, personally not that optimistic. I am, after all, self-professed pessimist. I don't buy into the entire legend. Much of this myth of Armistead, Bingham, and Hancock has largely been perpetuated by this monument and the text accompanying it by Sheldon A. Munn in his Freemasons at Gettysburg, published in 1993. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not going to bash Munn's book at all. Munn is a solid Civil War historian, better than me, certainly, and I find his text to be really a good resource. There is a lot of great information behind the creation of this monument, and it is also a really good resource for important figures at Gettysburg who were Freemasons and their Masonic record. Like, I didn't know George Pickett was a Mason until I was looking through that book. I also didn't know Chamberlain and Butterfield were Masons. I simply had no idea. Munn, through much research, approximate that at Gettysburg, almost 18,000 men were Masons. And of them, 5,600 Masons died there. That is of the approximate 100,000 Union troops and 73,000 Confederate troops. Those are not small numbers. Similar to preceding texts, Munn's booklet only briefly iterates the men behind the monument with very little scrutiny. As a result, it has cemented the story in the minds of Freemasons, telling the tale of brothers helping brothers during the war. As we have seen, such falls short of the truth. While this particular story is overhyped, probably false, this does not mean Masons did not help Masons during the war. In fact, they frequently did, and we have numerous accounts of such. That's why I recommend Hollerin's book, because he provides so many accounts of Masons helping Masons during the war, especially since such was illegal. They were designated enemies by their governments, and so they would have been insubordinated by, you know, for fraternizing with the enemy. Even their grand lodges would have prohibited fraternization, as grand lodges are going to side with their own government. And as Halloran outlines, he outlines several examples of grand lodges issuing explicit decisions and orders that prohibit fraternization. Yet, it was the brothers, not the grand lodges, that exhibited the grand spirit of Masonry. That a brother is a brother, and you are obligated to help them if you can and they ask. Okay, so the Masonic Monument at Gettysburg is based on a myth. Plenty of monuments are based on myths, so it's kind of not that big of a deal. I certainly feel the monument illustrates something bigger than the story it depicts, and that it illustrates that Freemasonry surpasses boundaries of enemy and friend, governments, and alliances. A brother is a brother, plain and simple, and we know for a fact that Masons help Masons in the war regardless of which side of the conflict they were on. When it comes to monuments, I take a very Nietzschean approach, namely the first of the three approaches to history as outlined in Friedrich Nietzsche's essay on the uses and abuses of history for life in his book Untimely Meditations. This approach to history he calls monumental history. For Nietzsche, history must serve life. Monumental history is where we memorialize something in history, be it an actual monument, or simply by saying something like, well, back in my day, we didn't do that. In some cases, such as, back in my day, monumental history may shut down anything new, monumentalizing the past for the sake of not changing things, regardless of whether or not it's a good idea. But sometimes monumentalizing history bolsters life. It inspires. It emboldens. And this monument at Gettysburg serves the life of Freemasonry in just that way. I love this monument as it boldly expresses how the fraternity surpasses all hindrances. A brother is a brother is a brother is a brother, no matter what. So what if the story behind the monument is an overblown legend? It expresses something much greater about Freemasonry, the grand spirit of brotherly love and affection, that no government, no war, no grand lodge, no nothing can impede or repel. The true tenets of the fraternity are realized by its brethren.
It is rather for us to be here dedicated to that great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
All right, as always, I want to thank worshipful brother Patrick Day for his diligent work in preparing these segments for us. Patrick has laid out the facts, and these facts were largely in part due to the investigative work of most worshipful brother Michael Halloran of Kansas, who put together his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Freemasonry and the Civil War, which recently was also published as a paperback through University Press. It is a phenomenal book, and as Patrick says, it is very much worth reading. What I found to be just so awesome about the text is that while he opens in the first chapter with the information regarding this particular event, the Friend to a Friend monument erected in 1993, well, any sour news you may have felt with that first chapter is quickly put to bed by many, many more stories that are validated by facts of things that had happened in that conflict that will just blow your mind. So, number one, get the book. Number two, I think the sentiment that Patrick puts here is that, yes, while the monument refers to an event of fiction, it stands for the idea of something greater. And let's face it, many times those things did happen. Brothers helped brothers all the time. As I've talked about in the past, I don't know what it is about Masonry that supersedes even war, but it's a mystery, an intriguing one at that. I want to switch over now to go under the quote-unquote Masonic liberal art of astronomy. Recently, something was published through NASA's email service about Europa Clipper exploring Jupiter's icy moon, and I thought this was just super interesting. So, the Europa Clipper is a spacecraft heading to, that's right, Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. I found this to be inspirational, and I hope you enjoy. And this comes from europa.nasa.gov. There's a legacy of NASA spacecraft carrying inspirational messages from Earth, from the Pioneer plaque and the Voyager Golden Record to engravings carried aboard NASA's Mars rovers. Now, as NASA sends a new mission from one ocean world, ours, to another, the Europa Clipper spacecraft continues this tradition, inspiring global interest and connection through its journey, connected by water. Water connects our planet Earth with Jupiter's moon Europa. The Europa Clipper mission aims to confirm that a vast ocean exists beneath Europa's icy surface, making it a promising place to study habitability for life beyond Earth. This shared element of water inspired the Europa Clipper team to engrave designs that celebrate human connections and our collective spirit of exploration on a triangular metal plate. The plate, made of tantalum metal about 1 millimeter thick and about 7 by 11 inches or 18 by 28 centimeters, is part of the structure that will protect Europa Clipper's electronics from Jupiter's harmful radiation. Water connects all life as we know it, and all human cultures. The outward-facing side of the vault plate features water words, quote-unquote, a visual representation of the word water in 103 spoken languages, extending from a central symbol that represents the sign for water in American Sign Language. Professional linguists helped to collect a diverse and inclusive sampling of human language families from across the globe. Audio recordings of these words are engraved on the vault plate as waveforms, visual representations of each sound. The circular symbol representing the sign for water in American Sign Language was created using a technique in image processing and data compression called a Fourier transform. Now, if you go to the website, I'll have a link to this website which will explore it, and you'll be able to see a picture of this awesome plate with all of these engraved waveforms with the word water in all of these different languages. You'll be able to go to the website and check out their waveform generator. Now, the waveform generator, it says, exploration is something we do together, something that connects us all as we head out into the cosmic sea. The waveform generator lets you experience the word water in over 100 spoken languages as well as American Sign Language. Listen, create your waveform graphic and share it to join our celebration of Earth's and Europa's interconnected stories. So you can, of course, play with the waveform generator, which is right there on the website. You can listen, create, share your graphic, and tag and use hashtags and stuff. It says, how were the languages selected? Well, NASA worked with a group of professional linguists to identify a set of languages from a broad range of language families to be engraved in the limited space available on the Europa Clipper vault plate. The goal was to identify a diverse set of language families to represent humanity on a global scale. A question that's posed is, can I suggest a language that is not included? Didn't find the language you were looking for? Share your own on social media and use the hashtag GoEuropaClipper hashtag. Anyway, very cool. You can check out that and a video all about the Europa Clipper and its unique triangular metal plate at europa.nasa.gov. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Now, something else that caught my eye in the realm of sciences this week was an article posted to sciencenews.org. I'll put a link in the show notes to this particular article as well, but I'll just give you the cliff notes here. And it says, why will this eclipse last longer and feature a more active sun? The article, titled "Why the 2024 Total Solar Eclipse Will Be Such a Big Deal," well, it's going to be quite amazing. And there were a number of events that were scheduled across the world, in more particular, the United States, about why this was going to be such a big deal. A lot of our New Age communities and wisdom schools, our philosophical-minded brethren, our esoteric brothers and sisters, this is an event that is going to be a very big deal. In fact, if you were to go to the best place in the world to view this eclipse, Waco, Texas, when this happens, you can expect to pay thousands of dollars for the simplest hotel room. Talk about price gouging. Well, let's check it out. A particularly active sun will make for a spectacular viewing and scientific opportunity. So the moon will be at a point in its orbit that's comparatively close to Earth in April, making the moon appear particularly large. As a result, for anyone fortunate enough to make it to the path of totality, where the moon completely blocks out the sun's disk, it'll be a especially dark eclipse that will last for nearly 4.5 minutes. That's almost 2 minutes longer than the Great American Eclipse of 2017. What's more is the sun will be closer to solar maximum in 2024. That's the peak of its roughly 11-year activity cycle. As a result, lots of bright petal-like streamers of plasma will extend from the solar corona. The sun's outer atmosphere, the increase of solar activity, also ups the chances of coronal mass ejection, a large puff of hot gas trapped in a loop of magnetic field that's blasted away from the sun's surface. A longer time to observe the eclipse and a more active sun will make it both a better show and a boon for scientists who have more telescopes, sensors, and satellites available to study the sun than ever before. Even viewers without other equipment should be able to see the streamers and a coronal mass ejection if it occurs. Something slightly different about the way this solar eclipse can be viewed. Now, I said the best place is probably Waco, Texas, but while that's a wonderful place to be, there are a number of places that span from the southwest all the way up into the northeast areas of the United States, and even into Montreal, Canada, and down into South America. Some large cities where you'll be able to see some of these, or at least cities that you may have heard of, along this particular belt where the solar eclipse will be best viewed, include places like Del Rio, Eagle Pass, San Antonio, Austin, Waco, Dallas, Texas, Hot Springs, Little Rock, Arkansas, Jonesboro, Arkansas, Carbondale, Illinois, Poplar Bluff, Missouri, Evansville, Terre Haute, Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, Muncie, Lima, Dayton, Ohio, Akron, Cleveland, Ohio, Jamestown, Buffalo, Rochester, New York, Syracuse, Cornwall, Waterton, Burlington, Montpelier, St. George's, Holston, Moncton, and Montreal. Those are the best places to view the solar eclipse that'll happen on April 8th, 2024. There are a number of ways that scientists are going to plan to study this one. You can read all about those in the actual article on thesciencenews.org. But again, this is going to be an astronomical event to remember. If you're somebody who studies astrology, astronomy, anything like that, this is going to be particularly of interest to you in both that area of your life as well as the area of life concerning the sciences, as we're called to learn them. Last up for this week, I want to mention something called the retreat. A few years back, we had something that was called Camp Masonry. Now, Camp Masonry was billed as a weekend for Master Masons. It was a unique Masonic retreat happening in Toledo, Ohio. Tickets for the event created more of a choose-your-own-adventure type weekend pass or a way to customize your stay. It was a really wonderful event, and I could not be more pleased with that experience. I think I was quoted as saying, "It was amazing, a best-kept secret in the Midwest Masonry. You have to make some time to go next year." And unfortunately, the event kind of fizzled out. We had some issues with planning and whatnot. So I've always been thinking about something to spark that again, and perhaps on a more personal level. And we don't have the resources that all of the fellas had when they did Camp Masonry, but think about a similar sort of experience. Not camping, perhaps, but something very unique. And I'm just going to invite you all, if you're listening, to the Space Novum Working Tools Retreat. This is an exclusive retreat. Currently, I'm the master of Space Novum this year, Lodge number 1183. It's Illinois' premier education lodge, and we're going to have an exclusive weekend retreat during the St. John's Feast at an incredible venue. The details of the event are that it will be June 21st through the 23rd this year. Not all of the members of Space Novum are going. There's no price breaks for members of Space Novum versus outsiders. Everybody's paying the same price. The price is all-inclusive, so you don't have to worry about anything else. Typically, guys will fly in somewhere, and they've got that cost, plus ticket cost, plus dinner cost, plus this, plus that, plus drinks, and all of this stuff, and it just really adds up. And by the end of something like, you know, going to perhaps Masonic Week, if you go to a bunch of things, you'll spend almost $1,000, sometimes more. This is significantly less, and we are, again, all-inclusive, which covers your room, participation in all activities, all the meals on Saturday and Sunday. We'll have guided meditations, prayers, and reflections. We'll have some world-class presenters, interactive meditative experiences, and even masterclass presentations. You can pay in installments so it doesn't hit you all at once, and you have to reserve your spot. So upon filling out the list, the RSVP list, you'll go on a list, and if you are amongst the, I think we're only allowed to have 16 people. If you're one of those 16, that includes myself and other people who are going to be going. Like, that's a hard number. It doesn't mean like 16 plus the presenters. It's including the presenters. So very limited, very intimate experience. We'll be exploring, you know, timeless principles of our craft, fostering genuine brotherhood through unique experiences. And when you get on the list, if you are one of the people who are within the first 16, then you will be, at some point in the near future, asked to provide a down payment via an email that will come to you. And if you're outside the 16, you'll be placed on a wait list and you'll be notified if there are cancellations. We'll do that on a first-come, first-served basis. And so I invite you to check it out. Again, this is not for everyone. I understand that there are a number of things that our brothers are going to and attending this year that may be taking up space and dollars out of your wallet. This particular retreat is something that's very special to me, also to the brothers of Space Novum Lodge, as this is the entire reason we started the lodge in the first place. To have experiences like this, and for the first time ever, we're opening it up to any Master Mason who'd like to attend. If you're interested, head on over to spacenovum.com, spacenovum.com/retreat, R-E-T-R-E-A-T, and you can get on the list. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us on this edifying episode. My thanks once more goes out to Brother Patrick Day for all of his work in preparing our Masonic Mythbusters segments. I want to thank all of our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast making this show possible. If you're curious on how you can help support the podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, or you can also check out the shop or the bookstore or anything like that. All of those things assist this show in bringing you the best, most trusted, and quality Masonic education available. We'll talk to you all next week, and until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care. Oh, and I'll see you at the Illinois Lodge of Research Symposium, right? Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
DIY Media.
Yeah.